What is going on, sports fans? Welcome into the Glass Half Full, an ESPN Pensacola podcast with me, Jordan Glass. Hey, thanks so much for tuning in. Got a lot to talk about today. A couple of game ones happened last night, and we'll look ahead to a game two happening tonight. So let's go ahead and just dive right into it. Dallas jumping out to that 1-0 series lead in the Western Conference Finals in the NBA as they take game one over Minnesota 108-105. Really was a great game. You know, this was a great game. Two good teams going back and forth, but the difference, and we talked about this over the last couple of days on the show, you know, the difference was going to be, could Dallas shut down Anthony Edwards? And they didn't necessarily shut down Anthony Edwards. He was able to make plays and find ways to score points for the Timberwolves. But really, the fact that Luka and Kyrie played as big as they did, and honestly, it was the way that they played. Almost like they complemented each other, right? Kyrie had a big first half, kind of trailed off in the second half. Luka played a little bit better in the second half, so they complemented each other. So when Kyrie was playing well, he was helping out Luka, who maybe wasn't having the best first half, and vice versa in the second half. Whenever, you know, Kyrie's starting to kind of cool off a little bit, Luka was heating up and getting warm, and that was great for the Mavericks. I think that was perfect and exactly. When we talk about how Luka and Kyrie have to be that anchor for them, that's kind of how they have to do it, right? If one's not making the plays, you got to rely on the other to step up and make those plays. They did a great job of that last night. And I mean, Luka, a good portion of his 33 points came in that second half and was also a big part of that 8-0 run within the last couple of minutes of the game to overcome that 102-98 deficit. You know, I mean, it looked like, honestly and truthfully, it looked like Minnesota was going to win game one. But again, 102-98 with about 3 minutes left in the game, you think, okay, it's, you know, that's a size lead that's for that amount of time left in the game. You got to think you got a pretty good shot at winning. I don't know exactly what the winning percentage index was on that of what it gave them as far as that X amount of percent of winning the game. But you got to think 102-98, you're less than 5 minutes from being done with the game. You've got a great opportunity there. But man, credit Dallas, especially like I said, Luka being a big part of that comeback right there within those final couple of minutes. To come back and win that game 105-108. Jaden McDaniels, Karl Anthony Towns, we talked about this before on the show yesterday as well, going into this game. They had to step up. They had to be guys that were players for the Timberwolves just in case Anthony Edwards was being shut down, like we saw happen against Denver in the Western Conference semifinals. Denver would shut down Anthony Edwards, and there really was nobody else to kind of step up and fill that spot. Well, Jaden McDaniels, Karl Anthony Towns did a great job last night. Both of them really did a good job, and I think that's why Minnesota had the success they did, and they were set up within those last couple of minutes to really have a legitimate shot at winning this game. But again, just credit Dallas, and Jason Kidd was talking about it, the head coach of the Mavericks after the game. He said, you know, this team never panicked in this game, no matter how much they were down, no matter what they were looking at. Even there in the last couple of minutes when they're down, you know, those that deficit of 102-98, you know, that four-point swing there, they never panicked. It was just a lot of trust. No matter how bad they were playing, how good they were playing, they just trusted each other. And that is one of the things why I like Dallas in this series. I really do, because Dallas trusts each other. Dallas is going to uplift each other. They're going to have each other's back. If one guy, like we talked about a minute ago with Luka and Kyrie, if one guy's playing down, the other guy's going to play up because he knows he has to. And that is all throughout this Dallas Mavericks team. And you can tell that they are coached by a guy like Jason Kidd because he's implemented that through this entire roster. Top, bottom, left, right. Everybody on that team knows that if my number's called, I got to step up and I got to help out the guys that maybe aren't playing well. And you see that with the Dallas Mavericks. Minnesota's still trying to figure some things out. I think Minnesota still, and we talked about this during the Western Conference semifinals against Denver. When Denver was shutting down Anthony Edwards, we talked about they got to bring in a couple of extra pieces. I still full-heartedly believe that they've got to bring in some of those pieces in the offseason. So I don't think they're quite there yet. I like Dallas in this series. I know it's still an early series, and we've got game two coming up, what, Friday night? So anything can happen in this series. Minnesota has proven that they are more than capable of winning in the NBA playoffs and have showed that they are more than worthy of being where they're at in the Western Conference Finals right now. But I just I like that comment from Jason Kidd. I think that is why I'm thinking Dallas is going to win this series, because they don't panic, right? They didn't panic. They come across some adversity against OKC in the semifinals, but they didn't panic. They trusted in each other. They overcame that. They ended up winning the series, moving on now. And again, last night, down on the ropes, playing maybe not their best game in the postseason, but they trusted in each other, and they were able to get things on track there and get that win to take the series lead 1-0. So we'll see what happens. Game two, again, coming up Friday night for that Western Conference Finals between the Mavericks and the Timberwolves. The Panthers and the Rangers got their Eastern Conference Finals started last night in the NHL for the Stanley Cup playoffs. And the Panthers, my goodness, 3-0 win over the Rangers in that game. Little bit of a surprise there. But again, take it with a grain of salt. Do we not remember how the Boston-Florida series started? Boston just absolutely demolishes Florida, and then Florida just goes on and just takes control of the series and clinches their spot in the Eastern Conference Finals. So let's take it with a grain of salt. But I think if you're a Florida fan, what you saw last night from the Panthers, you've got to be happy about. Bobrovsky, once again, an incredible night for him. 23 saves in the net. This is a guy that probably about the second period didn't really see much action, but all of a sudden in the third period, that action kicked up, and he had to make a lot of saves to keep that lead intact for the Panthers, and he did a great job of doing that. An interesting thing to keep an eye on, though, is that the Rangers, after starting the postseason 7-0, you know, they had a sweep the first round and then jumped out to a 3-0 lead over Carolina. They have lost three of their last four. So that is definitely something to keep an eye on. I'm not saying that the Rangers are going to lose this series. I do think the Rangers are the better team. I think they're going to have a great opportunity to tie it up coming up Friday night in New York in the Garden. But really, the Rangers, it is something worth noting that, you know, this time of year, teams start seeing some of that attrition and they start getting a little tired, start getting a little banged up. Maybe they're not playing as well. Maybe they're not playing as fundamentally sound as they were just a few games ago. So that's kind of the trend that we're seeing here with the Rangers, is that maybe they started off 7-0. They looked really good coming out the gate, and now that flame has kind of burned out, and it's just a little flickering ember there. We'll see if they can't ignite that tomorrow night for Game 2 and try to tie this series up. Looks like, speaking of tying the series up, tonight the Indiana Pacers will take on the Boston Celtics in Boston. You can actually catch the game. 7 o'clock is tip-off time on TV, on ESPN, but you can also listen to it right here on ESPN Pensacola 99.1 as well. Can Tyrese Halliburton and the Pacers finish a game? Remember, they had, what was it, a 15-20 point lead in game one and choked it away. Like, let's call it what it is. They choked in game one. They had a sizable lead. They should be the team with the 1-0 lead right now, but they choked it away and allowed Boston to storm back and take over that top spot. So I think when you look at this series, this is a pivotal game. This is a really pivotal game. Can Tyrese Halliburton and the Pacers not only finish the game, but can they do it on the road in Boston? It's definitely going to be a tough test for them. But I'm going to tell you what, if they go down 0-2, if they fall to the Boston Celtics tonight, it is going to be very tough for them to fight their way back into this series. Boston is the real deal, and you go down two games in a series to them, chances are you're not coming back in that series. You may get a couple of games here and there and maybe force a game six, but you're not going to get the series win. So this is a crucial game for the Pacers tonight. They have got to jump out just like they did the other night for game one. They've got to find a way to get a commanding lead like they did, but this time hold on to it. Got to finish the game. That is going to be crucial for them tonight. Move on now to the NFL. Looks like some interesting storylines around Jim Harbaugh as a coach, and then Jim Harbaugh as the Chargers coach. We'll start with the stuff about the Chargers coach, because I actually think this is very interesting what he's doing. He is completely overhauling the way the Chargers do things, right? I mean, he's bringing a new attitude to L.A. with him from Michigan. This guy has not allowed any music at practice so far during OTAs. Somebody that covers the Chargers said that, yeah, you know, look, in my time covering the Chargers, they've always had music playing in their practice. Now that Jim Harbaugh's there, that ain't happening. He's not allowing that distraction, that music, having guys out there dancing around, singing the lyrics instead of paying attention to what they need to be doing in practice. He wants them focusing on the plays, focusing on their jobs, on their assignments, and executing, because that's how you become a good football team. I don't disagree with that. I think it's great. I mean, you see a lot of, especially at the college level, and I mean, you even see it sometimes at high school, you know, going and covering high school practices, you know, doing a high school football here in the Panhandle. Some of these teams are just blaring music, and you've got guys that are not paying attention to what's happening on the field as far as practice. They're just out there dancing around and having little dance-offs on the sideline, or they're singing along with the lyrics or whatever, and they're not paying attention to practice. They're not focusing on what they're needing to focus on to get better. I feel like if you have a team that can focus on what they need to focus on to get better while also having the music playing, hey, it's absolutely fine. But if you think that's something that's kind of causing a little bit of a distraction, and I think Jim Harbaugh thought that heading into the situation with the Chargers, I think he thought that the music at the practice, a little bit of a distraction, so he wanted to make sure that, you know what, let's limit that. We're not going to allow music. That's not the only thing he's doing now. The final 10 minutes of the practice is geared towards conditioning and working out. That's right, Jim Harbaugh going old school. He's going back Junction Boys days with Bear Bryant. You know what I'm talking about? He is making these guys get out there and do wind sprints. After a full NFL practice, he's getting them out there running wind sprints and doing medicine ball carries for 10 minutes after practice. That's not going to be popular in the NFL, I'm telling you right now, with the way those players are. Because to them, it's a business. It's a paycheck. And they're thinking, I can work out in my own time. I can do conditioning in my own time. I need to go get in the cold tub and protect my body. I don't need to be out here doing this stuff. Are you kidding me? There's going to be some players that have that mindset. I guarantee you. It's not going to... At college, you got college kids coming out of high school. They're used to doing that stuff after a practice, right? So you don't really get a lot of you know, back talk or people not wanting to do it in the college level. But at the pro level, oh, they're going to be like, oh, we're professional athletes. We don't do conditioning after practice. We do conditioning and workouts on our own time. We have our own people that we do that with. I like all these things that he's implementing on the Chargers. I think it's going to help make them better. But it's definitely going to step on some toes, especially that last one with the 10 minutes of conditioning and sprint wind sprints and medicine ball carries after a full-length practice. Oh, that's definitely going to upset some of those players, for sure. Now, the ones that want to turn things around, the ones that want to compete and win a Super Bowl, they're not going to have a problem with it because they understand that that's why he's doing it. But there are going to be some players in that locker room that are like, man, this is BS. Why are we doing this? We'll see if that has any kind of repercussions as far as him being the guy moving forward. But I think Jim Harbaugh is going to get his guys in there, and it's going to be eventually he'll have a full team of guys that understand that that's how things are going to be done with the Chargers, and you're not going to do it any other way. Also with Jim Harbaugh, and this was very interesting to read, there's a new book coming out called The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. It's actually being published by CBS Sports. In that book, there's actually a chapter, and a portion of that chapter talks about how Jim Harbaugh actually did not want to leave Michigan to go to the NFL. He wanted to stay at Michigan after winning a national championship, but because of maybe some bad relationships and some bad blood, not only between higher-ups at Michigan but also the Big Ten, he decided it was his best decision to leave Michigan, his alma mater, the school he just won a national title for, and go to the NFL. Yeah, so it looks like inside that book, they talk about how the athletic director looks like he wanted him to go and kind of stand in front of the University of Michigan's Board of Regents and kind of, I don't want to say be on trial almost, but that's kind of like what it was, would or would be, for the sign-stealing situation and all of that stuff that transpired throughout last season. He wanted Jim Harbaugh to go stand in front of the Board of Regents and pretty much go through a due process of that. And it also goes into the fact that athletic director Manuel was maybe not necessarily Jim Harbaugh's biggest supporter after all of that went down. That maybe that caused a little bit of a frayed relationship, if you will, between athletic director Manuel and head coach Jim Harbaugh. So that is an interesting take. But then there's also some talk about some bad blood between Harbaugh and the higher-ups at the Big Ten and how the Big Ten was supposed to, the commissioner of the Big Ten was supposed to come out and talk to him after, you remember, they gave him that 3-game suspension because of the sign-stealing scandal. Well, apparently the commissioner was supposed to come to Ann Arbor and talk to him about that. The commissioner agreed to that, but never showed up. So there was some bad blood there between him and Jim Harbaugh because of that. So just all those things right there from that situation really kind of made Jim Harbaugh feel like, you know what, the best thing for me to do is to just go to the NFL, right? So apparently there were some conversations that were had a couple of days before he left going to his interview for the Chargers. So it was really kind of a situation where there was some sour grapes when he hopped on that plane to fly to L.A., to interview with the Chargers, and the interview apparently went well. The Chargers offered him the job, and he said, you know what? Do I stick around in Michigan with an athletic director who's not necessarily my biggest supporter? And do I continue to play in the Big Ten that's ran by people who are not necessarily my biggest supporter? Or do I go take a fresh start in L.A., in the sunshine, in Hollywood, and get back into the NFL, which, by the way, he had great success in the NFL, right? I mean, look what he did with the 49ers. He got them to a Super Bowl. There was that weird Super Bowl where the lights went out halfway through the game, and he was actually playing his brother with the Baltimore Ravens and John Harbaugh. So I think he's going to have success at the Chargers if the Chargers are patient with him. But I just found it very interesting that the only reason we have Jim Harbaugh back in the NFL now is because of the relationships that he had in a negative way with the athletic director and, of course, the Big Ten. So just kind of one of those things where you just come across it. And you have the wonderings and you have the suspensions or the suspicious like mind frame where you're like, was there a reason, maybe an internal reason as to why he decided to leave, especially after all that stuff happened? And I guess now we know, yeah, it is in fact because of some bad relationships that were formed because of that sign-stealing scandal. In the NFL, Tua Tagovailoa, starting quarterback for the Miami Dolphins, he has decided to slim down a little bit. And I saw pictures of him. He was at Nick Saban's charity golf tournament the other day. And man, he looks great. He looks slimmed down. He looks like he is in the best shape of his life. And in this, so much people are actually saying that are with the Miami Dolphins. They're saying, we've never seen Tua be in this good of shape in his time with the Miami Dolphins. Maybe at Alabama he was, but in his time in the NFL, he most definitely has not been in this good of shape. Obviously, last season, he was kind of bulkier and bigger heading into last season because, well, the Miami Dolphins actually asked him to do that, right? They asked him to do that. They asked him to take the jiu-jitsu classes. The jiu-jitsu classes were to help him fall properly, learn how to kind of fall properly so he could protect his head better. And then also, Mike McDaniel talked about it. They wanted him to kind of beef up a little bit, so maybe he's a little heavier and can't be ragdolled around as much because they felt like maybe getting ragdolled around on some of those tackles were why he maybe led to some of those concussions he had, getting kind of slung over the top of guys, his head hitting the ground. So they kind of were looking to find any way that they could prevent that happening. And I guess they really felt like throughout the season that the jiu-jitsu classes paid off more than him being bigger. So this offseason, he has really slimmed down. As a matter of fact, Mike McDaniel has referred to him several times through OTAs as svelte. He is svelte. Now, he didn't just do this just to kind of get into good shape. Mike McDaniels also said that he's slimming down to make him a little bit more mobile, because that was, again, another issue last year. Because, look, if you follow the NFL, especially if you follow the Miami Dolphins, you know that their offensive line is terrible. So, last year, Tua being a little bit bulkier kind of hurt him from being able to maneuver around in the pocket. Because if you go back to like his rookie and sophomore season, back when Brian Flores was still there and all of that, there were some times where a play would break down. He'd go to use his legs, and he would make plays. He's not a guy that's going to run. You're not going to have him take off. You're not going to run a read option offense or anything like that with him. But he's a guy who can make plays with his legs, and he can extend plays. And I think that's kind of why they wanted him to slim down. So that's definitely going to be interesting to see with the additions that they've added there on the offensive side of the ball, mainly with Odell Beckham Jr. How is that going to transpire into plays for the Miami Dolphins? Is Tua going to be able to stay healthy now that he's slimming back down? And if he does stay healthy, is he going to be able to find people downfield as what they're hoping to be, him slimming down, helping him extend those plays? Because their offensive line hasn't gotten any better, and that is for sure. Some more college football news, and we're going to close out today's show with this because, man, this is a doozy. First of all, have you seen the movie Varsity Blues, right? The movie Varsity Blues where the players are hurt, but the coach is like pushing the shots on them and stuff to make them get back into the game and maybe necessarily going against what the medical staff on the team is saying. It's a movie, right? You would never think a head coach would do that. Well, yeah, no, a head coach would do that, and it's actually a high-profile coach. Penn State head coach James Franklin allegedly interfered with Penn State medical team's decisions. So Dr. Pete Seidenberg was the team's primary care physician, and he was testifying earlier this week as part of a wrongful termination lawsuit involving former director of athletic medicine and orthopedics consultant Dr. Scott Lynch, who was fired from both of those roles back in March of 2019. Seidenberg took the stand and was talking about James Franklin and how there was a particular player for James Franklin that wanted to commit suicide, that was having suicidal thoughts and tendencies, and they were trying to give him psychiatric care, right? They were trying to help him and prevent him from taking his life. James Franklin went to the medical staff and said, I need you to medically disqualify this person from the team so that I can have a free scholarship open up. Are you kidding me? You've got a guy on your team who is having suicidal thoughts and tendencies and telling people that he's planning on taking his own life. And your medical staff for the team is trying to give him the help that he needs. And you are concerned about a scholarship, and you want this guy kicked out of the program, pretty much disqualified off of the team and out of the program? Well, guess what happens, James Franklin, if you disqualify him from the program? The people that are trying to help him can't help him. So you put him out on the street having those thoughts. That's strike number one, and that's the worst strike of them all. But also, Seidenberg also went on to talk about how James Franklin, they would have meetings. And this happens at college football teams all across the country on Friday nights before they play on Saturday. They sit down with the medical staff and players that are questionable, players that, you know, maybe could play in the game the next day, they sit down and they talk about them. And they say, okay, as a medical expert, how do you feel about this person playing? Should we set them out another game? And then they get the medical expert's advice, and they go from there as far as whether that player plays or not. James Franklin was bullying these doctors to clear players who had no business being cleared. We're not just talking about these guys who have sprained ankles, and it's like I was talking about a question of, well, do you think they could play? You know, is it something that we need to set them out, or if they really want to play and understand that there's going to be some pain? No. We're talking about players who still should be on, like, medical lists of these guys should not be back for another 3 to 4 weeks. James Franklin is trying to bully and push the medical staff to clear them for that game just because, hey, it's a big game and we need you on the field. That is absolutely ridiculous, because here's the thing, and Penn State should understand this more than anybody because of the things they've gone through in the past. Your coach is not just a coach. He has to protect those players. He has to protect anybody in the locker room, whether it is staff, whether it is a player, whether it's a water boy, whether it's an equipment manager. It doesn't matter. He has to protect them. That's part of his job as the head coach. Do not put them in more harm. This is some serious stuff for James Franklin. I know yesterday we talked about Billy Napier being sued by Jaden Rashada, and that's a big deal. Yes, that is a big deal in college football. But this right here, this is a fireable offense. Like, we are talking about a legitimate opportunity for the Penn State board to look at this and go, if this is what our head football coach is doing, he does not need to be our head football coach anymore. James Franklin can seriously, legitimately lose his job over this. Right now, people are just kind of talking about, oh, well, do you think he'll be suspended? Do you think, forget suspended, do you think he'll be fired? Not just for trying to get them to clear players before they're ready so they can play in a game, but also, come on, man, you've got a player on your team who is suicidal and is trying to take their own life. And you tell your medical staff to disqualify them and basically get them off of the team medically because of this, therefore rendering them without help? Man, that's shameful if you're Jim Harbaugh. Or excuse me, I did it again. If you're James Franklin. I'm used to talking about Jim Harbaugh in the Big Ten and coaches being in trouble in the Big Ten. Can you tell? But seriously, if you are James Franklin, you're in a world of trouble right now. And you know what? When things like this happen, if there are any other circumstances, if he did things like this when he was at Vanderbilt in the SEC, oh, somebody will come out and say something. Whether it's a former player at Vanderbilt that was like, yeah, James Franklin made me play with an injury that I shouldn't have played in. He made the injury worse by making me go out there and play. Or it'll be one of his staff members from his time at Vandy. You can't just sweep this under the rug, man. This is serious, and it's something that is definitely, for sure, going to at least cost him some games this upcoming season, if not his job entirely. That is going to do it for today's show. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Glass Half Full and ESPN Pensacola podcast with me, Jordan Glass. Have a great Thursday. Hey, it'll be a finally Friday tomorrow. You know what that means. It'll be yet another way too soon. I'll have a good one for you tomorrow.